Is there anybody in here who this is their first feast with us? Okay. You're really the crowd this talk was for. The others just evidently didn't like my competition, so they're in here. They're my friends and my support. So I actually had kind of two talks arranged. But I feel like when you come to our festival, you know, a lot of us have been coming to this festival for 10, 12 years. We've seen it evolve from when we started out, we had one banner on the wall. That was it. That was decoration. Wow. And we've just gradually added to it. We have... We had some really terrible music when we first started out, the music program. We needed a music man. We needed an audiovisual person. And here came Lee Miller. And he has fulfilled that job for us very well. And we're really, really thankful for him. We don't want anything to ever happen to him. Because I don't know who would fill his shoes. Certainly not me. But the flavor of our feast changes from year to year as we grow. When we first started out, there was no liturgy included in our services. And now we're having some liturgy in the service. You've heard a lot about prayer. I had a long discussion last night about the morning prayers and how they're handled. And that may evolve into a breakout session next year for people who are interested in maybe starting to pray or just have more information about using a siddur, which the morning prayers are in there along with a lot of other stuff. But you know, to give you a little of my background, I'm a Reformed Baptist. I wound up getting information from the Worldwide Church of God. I never belonged to the Worldwide Church. I belong to the Church of God International. I was there about 5 years, and then the leadership, he was indiscreet. And the ministerial council wouldn't throw him out. So me and my wife left, and then about 2 years later, his indiscretion with somebody else came up, and they finally threw him out. But by then, we had already moved toward Hebrew roots. We had a really good friend, Mitchell Smith. He used to show up at, we'd have like a Feast of Trumpets. We'd have seven churches come together for a festival. And he'd come in with this big brown grocery bag under his arm. And he'd start passing out tape series, usually by Joe Good. But he had thought about those because it wasn't like, here, you take this and you take that. Every one of them that he gave you had your name written on it. He had stopped and thought about, you know, where you were in the walk, and he thought this would help. We used to stay overnight with him when we went over to Tyler to go to church, and me and Donna would drive home and we'd say, do you know what crazy stuff they're doing? You know, and here we are. We're doing this crazy stuff. But for new people, that this is your first ever feast, you know, you come in and we start throwing Hebrew terms at you. We say, let's do the Shema, and everybody turns around and they're, some of them holding up hands, some of them not. And we say the Shema, but it's something that we have grown into. And, you know, new people come in, they kind of look like, What's going on? What is this? That's why we put a Hebrew glossary in the back of our book to help you understand a few of the words that we feel are commonly used. But if you're new to the walk altogether, you have all these other questions, you know. If you came out of a Christian church, you can see that this is a different atmosphere. We still worship Yahweh. We call God Yahweh because that's his name in Hebrew. We don't demand that everybody does it because it's a thing you grow into. You know, I didn't use sacred name for a long time, but I deal mostly with prisoners in Texas prison. Donna and I have been in that service for going on 15 years now. And when I went in, I was teaching from the perspective of Church of God. But as I grew, I began to teach Hebrew root perspective. And now all the classes that I do are basically Hebrew root classes. I don't claim to be any kind of scholar. I go into prison and I go in as a Torah teacher. I'm also a Torah learner because every year when we go through the Torah, I learn a lot.
How many prisoners now do you teach? I mean, you go to how many prisons and what would you say your collective congregation would be?
Okay, we go to six different prisons, one of them being a woman's prison. We do five Sabbath services every month. A couple of Sabbaths would double over. We do a home study at our home then on fourth Sabbath every month. Over 15 years, we baptized a little over 100 men, and my congregation congregate right now is somewhere in the neighborhood of 200, but it's growing. And we are faced with limitations. Sometimes we get a warden doesn't like what we believe, and they will limit the things we can do. Sometimes chaplains don't like us, you know, keeping the law. You're legalistic. So they're the people that can control our time and who gets to come to our service. We can't just put out a call and anybody in the prison system that wants to come to our service. They have to have a pass signed by the chaplain. So there's some inherent problems there. We could show up at a prison that we have driven 4 hours to get there, and we get to the front gate and they say, you can't hold your service because of security. That is their word. No, it's not a lockdown. Now, we can't go in during lockdown. Lockdown is when the whole prison is locked down and they go cell by cell and they go through everything. They're looking for contraband and they always find a bunch of it. Basically, if you've got access to some kind of exchange, either money or commissary goods, you can get anything in prison that you want. You know, that's just the way the system is. It's a terrible system. It is a huge waste of manpower. These guys, some of them have work to do, but most of them are just there. And when a man's been in prison for 40 years, culture has passed him by. I don't care how much TV they've watched, culture has passed them by. We've got a man that got out of prison on the 2nd of this month, 3 days ago. He had no family. He's got the $100 they let him out of prison with. They gave him a suit of clothes, which by suit of clothes, I mean a pair of pants and a shirt, and this time of year, maybe a jacket. They may or may not fit him. They may or may not match. And, you know, that's it. They open the door and they say, goodbye, we'll see you later. Because that's what happens to so many prisoners that get out. They got no family. They got no place to go. Put yourself in their position. You've got to have a job. To have a job, you need a telephone. To have a telephone, you need a place to live. About the cheapest motel that I could rent one of these guys in town is $30 a night. So if he didn't eat, he can stay in a motel 3 nights. That means he's got access to a telephone. But he goes, you know, used to you could go out to a construction job and say, look, I need a job. The guy says, fine, I need this. And he'd put you to work right then. But with the climate the way it is now, the jobs are not as plentiful to start with. And employers, they say, you know, fill out this. I must have been 35 before I filled out the first application for employment. Otherwise, I had just walked up on the job. I said, I can do this. They said, fine, go to work. But they're taking these applications on the back of them. There'll be a place that says, have you been convicted of a felony? If they check that no, and they have committed another felony. If they check it yes, the interviewer, and so many of them are on the internet. You don't even see a real person. But somebody on the internet will read that and say, oh, this guy's got a felony. And they just turn them away. So jobs are hard to find. My son happens to be an ex-prisoner. And he has to work through manpower, these day jobs. He gets one job that he can work 800 hours a year. 800 hours, full-time job. At the end of the 800 hours, if he's done a really good job, which he has for this company, they would love to hire him, but the parent company in Oshkosh or whatever, they say, we don't hire permanent employees who have a felony. So at 800 hours, he has to be released because on a part-time contract, you work 800 hours and you either have to be cut or you have to be hired full-time. So it's a real challenge for prisoners out there. And I didn't mean for this to turn into a prison ministry, but the guy at my house, no money, no family, the state operated on his leg for something. I don't remember right now what it was, but he's on crutches, another thing. You know, it's harder still to get a job if you walk in, you got crutches. So he's at our house, and my son's loose herding him, which may or may not turn out well. I don't know. My son is he's a non-starter. You know, he's got some skills, but he doesn't have the go-get-it-ness to run a business. So We'll be home, you know, in another week. We can take care of things there. But for people coming into this, I met a woman here who this is her first festival anywhere ever. And after I talked to her, I met a man who was just coming out of Worldwide. He'd gone to 30 festivals, and now he's at our festival. And it's a serious change of mind thought. You know, you talk about, or some of the speakers talk about our Greek mind thought. As Greeks, and the way we're taught, there is a past, we're in the present, there's going to be a future. But in biblical speaking, it's really all happening at once as far as Yahweh's concerned. He always lives in a presence that we cannot possibly understand. The past, the present, the future, he sees them all at one time. He gives us our festivals so that we operate in a cycle. We take the past, but we bring it to our present. And we know that these festivals are only a shadow of something that's going to happen in the future. So we're here as a rehearsal. Now, if any of you have ever been in a play, you know how strange and funny rehearsals can be. People mess up their lines and all this sort of stuff. But people come to us I couldn't light the candles in my house. Said I might not do it right. Well, there's no commandment in this book to even light candles. So it's a tradition. There's nothing wrong with tradition as long as it doesn't offend this. You know, Jewish have some really fine traditions. They have some I don't agree with, so I don't do them. At our house, on the Sabbath, we normally light a big candle and it'll burn for 24 hours. That's our tradition. Most people light two candles and they'll just let them burn out. And that's okay too. You know, there's no right or wrong with that. And as we have grown, our traditions change a little bit. For those of you who might have children, your Sabbath observance is going to be entirely different from what Don and I, because it's just us and whoever we can gather up. But basically, it's just us. We're on the road a lot of Friday nights. So we carry a little tea candle with us, and we light it, and it burns out, you know, and we have a little wine, a little bread, and that's the way we started there, but at home, we started even different. So in your own home, you need to develop traditions that you're comfortable with. Don't light candle just because I light candles. It's not a good thing. If I were to tell you something in this teaching, you know, don't believe me. Go here. If it's not in here, don't believe anything I say till you've proven it here. I tell that to prisoners all the time. One reason I think I like prisoners is they've got a lot of time on their hands. They do a lot of study. A lot of them are really sharp people. So I have to stay on my toes to even stay even with them. And cream rises to the top. I've got a leader, inmate leader in each one of the congregations. And basically, they're the liaison between me and the chaplain. You know, I can call the chaplain, but it works a lot better if he knows who these leaders are. If they go to him and say, this is what we'd like to do. Because then they can answer questions, and they might not come up on the phone, you know. But if you come to our festival, I meant to bring my tallit this morning, but I didn't. You'll find some people wearing the tallits. You see some people got kapahs on. Some got a hat. Some got a baseball cap. You know, what about head coverings? How about women and head covering? You know, these are questions that come up. And I'm not going to tell you, women, you need to have a head covering. But if you read Scripture, it talks about a woman covering her head because she's under the authority of her husband. I cover my head because I'm under the authority of my husband, Yeshua. And it doesn't matter what you cover your head with. I'll be home, Don will be getting horsey, and I'll take a kitchen towel and put it over her head and tell her, you need that head cover. So she doesn't wear one at home. She wears one on the Sabbath, things like that. Again, this is a personal decision thing. The Bible does not say that men have to wear a head cover. It just does say that women wear them in deference to their husband. And Donna will be the first to tell you, she does not wear that head covering in deference to me. She wears it in deference to Yeshua. Okay? She's a good woman, but she is hard-headed. I've been working on her for 43 years, and I have not hardly made a dent. She's a Yankee on top of that.
Such a lover.
Yeah, you know, we, last night in the conversation, we were talking about prayer, and it came up that this young woman had lost her husband. And they said that she wasn't coming to service very often, because she's still devastated by the loss of her husband. And, you know, we've been married 43 years, and I know that 70, I'm not very far from that. In the last couple of years, I was in the hospital at one time, and the doctors said that I probably wouldn't make it. But Yahweh seems to have something else planned for me because I'm here. Donna had a heart attack in 1999. We had just left Feast, had a great time. She's in good shape. And we had gone home. We had thrown out the Feast stuff. We had gathered up stuff. We were headed to Ohio. She has a heart attack in Memphis, Tennessee. But once that heart attack happened, you know, you ask, why do bad things happen to good people? Once that heart attack happened, and it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and she had woke up and said, I need a bathroom, which was not an unusual occurrence for her. But usually I drive 30 miles down the road before I find a place to stop. But there was immediately a hotel. I'm sorry, convenience store We went in there, and there, of course, 2 o'clock in the morning, there's nobody else in there, and she goes in the bathroom, and she's in there, and she's in there, and she's in there, and I'm really getting concerned about her. Now, she hadn't said a word to me, but I was fixing to go in there because I knew there wasn't anybody else. She comes out, and she, you know, I had a jacket kind of like this. She grabs my lapels and says, "Do you know what a heart attack feels like?" And I said, "Well, no, I really, really hadn't had any experience there." But I said, "You think you want to go to the hospital?" And she is not a hospital person. And she said, "Yeah." Turns out that the hospital is only like 8 blocks away. We get over there, and I take her into the emergency room, and there is a brand new doctor who has just gotten out. His specialty is hearts. And he gave her this stuff called a clot buster. And when he told us about it, I thought, that's the silliest thing I ever heard of. But he said, "I'm going to give her 2 shots of this, and if she's got any kind of scab on her, it'll begin to seep." She had a fever blister. And within about 2 minutes, she's got this clear liquid running out of there. It has broken up the clot underneath there. Within a few minutes, she feels a lot better. And, you know, she asked doctor, "Can we go on?" He said, "No." He said, "You are having a heart attack." So, as it turns out, this hospital only has 8 ICU rooms. Every room had a patient on it that was on a ventilator. They could not move, not one of them, to put Donna in ICU. So he said, "Look, I'm going to call across here and get you over to Methodist Central." We were actually in West Memphis, Arkansas. So we went across the river to Memphis. She went in. And you don't just walk up to that hospital and go in, because it is a teaching hospital. You have to have a doctor sign you on before you can even go in the emergency room. We went over there, and of course I called people I knew. There's a prayer network goes up. After Donna settled into the room, I have people show up that I don't know, but they know somebody who knows somebody that I know. And they were just super helpful and super supportive. And, you know, it just gives you a feeling of peace to know that things are under control. I would sit there in a room this big, and it's full of people who they're there for their loved one to have a heart transplant or bypass surgery or 100 other things that deal with the heart and lung, the center of your body. And I don't remember what our doctor's name was. But, you know, you're sitting and you don't have anything else to do. So you start to talk. And they would ask, "Who's her doctor?" And I'd say, "Well, he's Dr. So-and-so." And they'd just look at me in amazement and say, "Nobody gets him. He's got like a 2-year waiting period. If you need bypass surgery, you better schedule it way back there if you're going to get him." But he was her doctor. We had no insurance, and he got us onto a clinical program, which paid a portion of the bill that we would owe. But he operated on her. He showed me some pictures. And the body is a wonderful thing. We are wondrously put together. He showed me pictures of where the artery was blocked. And it had already, above that blockage, started to grow out a new artery that was going to grow around and would eventually reattach itself to the heart. You know. But she went through a triple bypass surgery. She was in the hospital in recovery 4 days. Her doctor walked in and said, "Why don't you get out of my hospital?" She was doing great. I nearly killed her going home. Hospital did good for her, but we were headed back home, and we got over to Little Rock, and I asked her if she wanted to stop for the night, because, you know, she was getting a little pale. And she said, "No, I'll be all right." So I drove over to Texarkana. When I got there, she was really drained. So I checked into a motel and got her in there. And she just went to sleep for about 3 hours. And then she woke up and said, "I'm hungry." And I said, "What do you want to eat?" And she said, "Mexican food." So we went to a Mexican restaurant. And after that, we jumped down to the Kelly house and stayed there one afternoon. Went to some other friends in Tyler. Spent the night there. And then it's just a short hop home. She's in better shape heart-wise now than she's ever been, you know. But it's all in God's hands. He says, "I'm not going to stop this heart attack from happening, but I'm going to take care of you." And we have to understand that when we come to Him, we are forming a relationship. And as bad as it might sound, your relationship with Yahweh and Yeshua is more important than your husband, your children, your house, your car, your job, your family. Because if you're going to walk this walk, if you've been a Sunday keeper, you know, like I was raised Baptist and my whole family still is, unfortunately, except my brother. I prayed for years for one of my family to be converted, to just come to believe what I believe so we could go to the feast together. You know, and if I'd have made a list of my family, my brother had been way down here. Because he's a former alcoholic, former drug addict, former Hell's Angel person, you know. So, anyway, he began asking a few questions. I started spoon feeding him stuff. And he came around to this belief. He came to the first festival, and we were in Oklahoma, and he has a grandson who lives in Wichita Falls, Texas. So he said, "I'm going to hang out here a couple of days, and then I'm going to go see my grandson." Okay. So a couple of days went by, and he's at service every day, and he's taking part in the stuff we're doing. And, you know, the third day I look up, he's in the back of the room. And I said, "Thought you were going to see your grandson." He said, "I will." So the next day he's in the back of the hall. He stayed the whole feast. He stayed the extra day so that we could get everything packed up and get out of there. You know, and he's been at every feast since then. He doesn't do what I think he ought to be doing. I think he ought to be a teacher, but he really feels uncomfortable with the concept of that role. My wife feels uncomfortable being a speaker or a teacher. You don't know, for you women that are going to the women's luncheon, you have no clue how hard it was to get her to speak. And I mean, she's a wonderful teacher. But I told her the other day when we had picked up this woman's prison, I said, you're going to have to take a lead role. Because I don't know if you guys know this or not, women are different than we are. Yes. You know, and especially in a prison setting. But there are issues in the women's mind that I may not really have a good grasp on. So she's beginning to take up that role, and I'm more than willing to take a secondary role. But, you know, the question to come up when you come to the feast, if you've been going to a Christian church, you know, during the service they pass that plate around. Tithe, send it to God, but then they give you their address. So you'll find here that we're not going to pass the plate. When you registered, you found a donation box that was for the hamburger supper. There was a box there for people who had not donated or had not registered. There's a box at the meeting hall, and it's all free will gifts.
Voluntary.
Fortunately, we are doing just a little bit better than breaking even. But that allows us to improve our equipment, establish new programs. You know, youth program costs money. Teen program costs money. And we don't charge anybody. So people come in, they say, well, what about the tithe? And if you really study the tithe, you'll find that the tithe was not always to be sent to the church, per se. The temple. It was given to the Levites, the ones that were teaching them. They were the welfare program. If you were in a situation and you needed help, you went to the Levite. He lived in your town. He knew you. And if you're just this lazy lout that doesn't want to work, he'd say, nah, got nothing for you. But if you're a true widow, or if you've had an accident, you can't work, then there was a storehouse that you could draw from. But it was controlled by the Levite that lived in your town. So what most people don't understand about tithe is that is God's money. When you set aside a tithe, whether you put it in a savings account, you put it in a glass jar, you put it under your mattress, whatever you do with it, that's God's money. Now, when we're reading Leviticus 23, he says, you're to have a holy convocation at these festivals. Okay. That's a commandment from Yahweh for us to appear here. Now, let's put it back in the vernacular. Thank you. If you have a job and your boss says, I want you to fly to Chicago and attend this conference, what do you expect? You expect him to provide you with airfare, meals while you're there, a place to sleep, you know, and maybe some money so that you can buy somebody else food and make that social network that is so necessary in business relations. Okay, we expect that from our secular bosses. Would Yahweh be any different? He says that you're to gather up your tithe, put it in your hand. If it's something that's going to spoil or rot before you can get the stuff there, he says, put it in your hand. Take it with you. Buy the things you want. When you come to the festival, you should live a notch above what you do at home. You should meet new people. Where we used to meet, there was a restaurant attached to the lodge. And I encouraged older people to take those new people just coming in. Take them to lunch. Sit and talk with them. One of the worst feasts I ever went to was with Church of God. And we went out to Lake Tahoe, California. Absolutely beautiful place. But it was the only feast the church had on the West Coast. So by October, all the guys that go there year after year after year, they had a calendar and they already had everything scheduled in for the day. You went to the church meeting, and when the amen was said, they jumped up and scattered like quail. Now I wasn't new to the church, I was just new to that feast site. They just left you standing in the middle of the floor. And I hope that we do not do that. You know, the people that have been at our feast site for a long time should, you know, that's why we ask, is this your first feast? Is this your first feast with us? What we want to do is have the older people that have been at our feast for years to look around and find y'all and say, hey, come over to my kitchen. We'll have lunch. Or you know, we used to have meals, community meals, where everybody got together at the same spot. Kind of like that hamburger supper the other night, only cut that about in fourth, and that's all the people we had. So we were able to have these potlucks. Well, you know, it just finally gets to the point where a potluck doesn't work anymore. It's got to be more organized. Mark and his crew served 900 portions. Now, admittedly, some people went back and got more than one. But if this had been something we were paying by the plate for, we would have used 900 plates for hamburger supper. You know, and those things cost money. We used to ask that all the people that were coming to the hamburger supper, for that night, you go uptown, you buy your hamburger, and then you bring it to us. Some people would buy patties, some buy bulk. Some would buy 95% lean. Some would buy 73% lean. And then we had to have people that mixed it together and made patties. And you'd have a guy show up and he's got two patties and he says, these are buffalo meat. And that's what I want. You get buffalo meat and beef on the same grill, once they turn brown, there is no way to tell them apart. So if somebody wanted that, they had to come out there and really watch over their own stuff, because we couldn't do anything else about it. We had people that eat kosher. We tried to have a kosher meal, I think the second year we were there, totally kosher meal. And it was such a disaster because guys like me that were not into the kosher thing, we didn't understand all the rules. I was the one that contaminated the kosher table. You know, live and learn. But, you know, the people come to our feast and they've come out of the Christian church and they say, well, what do I do on the Sabbath? Our better question is, what can't I do on the Sabbath? The Sabbath was designed to be a day of rest, recuperation, recreation, time to take a walk in the park, just admire the creation that Yahweh had made for us. Think about this. He could have made our whole world black and white. Would you like to live in a black and white world? No, I wouldn't.
We wouldn't have known the difference.
Well, we might not. But when I look at a forest, like looking across the lake, those trees on the other side, there's probably 900 shades of green. And now it's beginning to have some shades of yellow and gold and red and orange. You know, and this is our Creator. He didn't have to do that. So the day that He set us up, He said, if you will just quit, you know, don't think about what you've got to do Monday morning. Just settle down, sit, rest. That's basically what Sabbath means. It means to cease. And He says, this is my day. I've given it to you. You know, He created Adam on the sixth day, and the first thing He did was give him a day off. Can't ask for a much better boss than that. But, you know, the people say, well, I can't do this, and I can't do that on the Sabbath. You have free choice. You can do anything you want on the Sabbath. What Yahweh says is, I set this side apart, and if you will rest and focus on me, I will come and be with you. And that's part of that relationship we have to build. It's part of that thing that gives us the strength to carry on when we think we're carrying the whole burden of the world. You know, we can either be crushed by it, or we can know that our strength comes from Yahweh and Yeshua, and that we will, there's an old saying, this too shall pass. It doesn't matter how black it looks right now. There is light right around the corner. But He wants us to trust Him. He wants us to love Him with all our heart. And when you become a Christian, how many of you believe you're in a blood covenant relationship with Yeshua? Nearly everybody in the room. Well, a blood covenant, excuse me, allergies are killing me up here. A blood covenant relationship would mean that the terms of the covenant were written out, and both parties agreed to them. We found that in the covenant with Abraham. Although Abraham, you know, he agreed in theory with what God wanted, he wasn't there to sign the covenant, because Yahweh knew that being human, he could not keep the covenant. So Yahweh took both sides of it. Therefore, we have a covenant that is eternal. It is unbreakable. We serve a covenant-keeping Elohim. He's our king. He makes covenants. He keeps them. If he doesn't, then your salvation is not assured. If he has made a covenant, he will stick to it. But when you sign the blood covenant with Yeshua, he says what he will do. And we sign on to that covenant. You know what? Our part of it's blank. What's he going to want you to do? I don't know. I'm not even sure what he wants me to do. But whatever you find to do, you should do. And I like to study. I like to study prophecy. All of these things. But my ministry is based out of Matthew 25. There Yeshua is separating believers from almost believers. And he says to the believers, they call them sheep, he said, come on in to the kingdom. And they say, well, you know, what did we do to deserve this? I was hungry, you fed me. I was naked, you clothed me. I was in prison, you came and visited me. And all these things, and you'll notice it doesn't say, I studied Torah 40 hours a week. I knew how to speak Hebrew. None of that. Although I agree that all of that is important. The important thing in our life is once we've established that relationship, that we show that relationship to other people by what we do for them and to them. You know, there are just some people that are really hard to get along with, and you'll cross the street to avoid them. The Bible calls those kind of people enemy. And it says that you shouldn't hate your enemy. You should pray for your enemy. You know, the best way to get rid of an enemy is to make him your friend. You know, and if you're nice to people that are argumentative and hard to get along with, it drives them nuts. Because they cannot figure out what you're doing. You know, but if you are consistent with what you do, then eventually they normally start to come around. These are just things that, you know, the emphasis gets changed. Like, say, I grew up in Baptist church. I never heard a sermon about the Feast of Yahweh. You know, when they referred to the Old Testament, it was, oh, let's look at this story of David and Goliath, Jonah and the big fish. You know, they'd sometimes read about the Exodus, but it was, you know, God brought all these people out of slavery, And that's where they end the story. It wasn't about the 40 years of trial and test. It wasn't about going into the promised land. And we have a promised land to go to. Someday, we will be gathered back to go to Israel. And it's not going to be that little slice of land. If you read what Yahweh promised Abraham, you know, it's from the Euphrates River. When the when the war in Iraq started and all this news was talking about they just, you know, swept across the Euphrates, I said, call Israel, tell them to come get their land. You know, but that's our northern boundary. Israel, even under Solomon, never controlled all the land that Yah said belonged to Israel. Got 1 minute before questions or after? If you think this went by, wait till my next session. I could have had 4 hours and not covered all the stuff really needs to be covered.
My wife would be ticked off. There we go. Pick her up.
Well, mine's going to have to go get ready for her luncheon. But my talk today was really, I was hoping to have the newer people come. Hebrew language is an action language. And if we are going to be Hebrews at heart, we need to be people of action.